You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. Today we'll be joined, as we are every week, by the beat reporters from the Central. A little twist this week, when in addition to the usual news and notes, we're going to talk franchise four. It's MLB.com's voting initiative going on right now. You can vote until May 8th on the four most impactful players who best represent the history of each franchise. We're going to get our beat reporters' picks from their respective franchises, and a lot of tough decisions come out of that, and the results will be unveiled at the All-Star Game in Cincinnati this summer, so something to look forward to there. Thank you all for tuning in. Here we go. Back, the Tigers, Miguel Cabrera had a nice weekend yet again against the Cleveland Indians. He tends to do that. 15 for 23 on the season against the Indians with three home runs and nine RBI. I know he's off to a strong start in general, but what is it about that team? They tried to pitch him around him. He had his first four-walk game of his career and then had to come back in the strike zone a little bit, and he made him pay again.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things where he's, you know, Miguel's very good at studying pitchers, and while he doesn't necessarily keep a book on these guys, he keeps a mental record, and he's got a better memory than I think a lot of people realize. So he knows why these guys like the back of his hand. In fact, he was talking the other day about, you know, how he saw a different pitch from Carlos Carrasco than he remembered. And it was like, they really haven't, I mean, they've seen him a little bit, but they haven't seen a ton of him. And it was impressive that he's got that vivid of a memory of him. And he was talking about making the adjustments. And, you know, and this was the guy he ended up getting, you know, a couple of hits off of. And then they bring in Atchison, and you think you've got him figured out. And then he goes and, you know, gets an opposite field home run. I think the way they try to approach him, trying to avoid, you know, giving him anything to pull, sometimes it plays into that ability to go the opposite field, and it just, no matter what they seem to do, it doesn't seem to work except for the throw him four balls and try to deal with Victor Martinez.
Another guy who had a nice weekend, Alfredo Simon. He now has a 1.65 ERA. He's won all four of his starts. I'm sure he's loving his new home park, especially after pitching that bandbox in Cincinnati, but we talked before about Shane Green. Let's talk about Alfredo Simon. And these guys are really holding up the rotation in a meaningful way, especially with, you know, Justin Verlander's situation ongoing. Has Simon exceeded expectations in your mind?
Yeah, I think he's exceeded him quite a bit. And when they got him, they were looking for somebody to give him a chance to win and, you know, go out there every time out and try to give him some innings. You know, basically be a mid-to-back rotation starter. And I think after spring, you know, as spring training was wrapping up, you were kind of wondering if he was more of the mid-rotation guy or the back-rotation guy compared with Green. Well, you know, so far, he's shown the ability to make adjustments. He reads hitters well. And he's just got this deceptiveness that I think has allowed him to make that jump from the National League to the American better than a lot of us expected. He's been able to keep the ball on the ground a little bit more than I figured. And at the same time, he knows how to use the dimensions of Comerica Park with his hand. So it's really been kind of interesting to watch. And when you look at the four-game winners in the majors, after 3 weeks, I mean, who would have thought you'd be seeing him on the list?
Yeah.
It's kind of, as much as everybody wants to talk about Bartolo Colon, I think Colon's done it before, even at his age. He's got that track record. I don't know if Simon, even after last year, has had that track record where you really thought something like this was possible.
Well, as I said, I mean, it's a big deal with Justin Verlander still in the holding pattern. We're still keeping tabs on that. It's been a month now that he's been dealing with his injury issue. Last week, Joe Nathan's season ends. He has a UCL strain, so he'll need Tommy John. And What was the deal with Al Albuquerque? There were, like, some reports he's hurt, some reports he's not hurt. He's got a sinus infection. He doesn't have a sinus infection. I think he's got a sinus infection. We nailed that down. But everything else seemed...
That's what he says. He says he's got a sinus infection and he had to see a doctor about it. And he said in some ways it was affecting his pitching because his eyes would get watery. And it would kind of affect his vision a little bit, especially when he was in his delivery and everything. It was a little bit unusual, to say the least. But arm-wise, he says he's fine, and the Tigers are taking him at his word that there's nothing structurally wrong there. His velocity bumped up a tick last time out. It looked a little better. He sacrificed some command, it looked like, to get it there. But, I mean, you know, this is a guy who looked really good in spring training. I mean, the fastball was mid-90s. He was mixing in a lot of two- and four-seamers, and he had the slider working as always. Right now, it kind of looked like everything's a little bit flat. And, you know, it's hard to tell if it's cold weather or just him feeling blah or something else. But, he doesn't look like the same Albuquerque. And I think, even Brad Ausmus admitted that the other day.
Back too soon to know the Rajay Davis groin situation. Of course, he had that issue in the postseason last year, so it's the first thing that springs to your mind, but probably too soon to compare the two, I'd imagine.
Yeah, he says it's not nearly as severe and that he only thinks it's going to be a day-to-day thing. It's going to be a bigger test how he feels in the coming days and, both how sore it gets and also how quickly some of that soreness starts to subside, and they can kind of figure out whether it's a strain or whether he avoided the strain. He thinks he kind of dodged some real trouble there by slowing up when he did, as opposed to trying to accelerate through it and maybe doing something a little bit more severe. So at this point, a guy like that at age 33, 34, I guess you kind of have to trust him to know his body. But he also knows he's kind of on a hot streak right now, and he's getting a good share of playing time, and I'm sure he doesn't want to give that up.
Yeah, there's legit battle for playing time at center field, the way Anthony Gosa started off. Now, he's striking out a ton, Beck, but he's got that .333 average kind of carried over from the hot spring he had. He's also got he's got a .560 batting average on balls in play, which you would imagine would start to come down. What do you make of Gosa's offensive start?
I think you see a lot of the swing he had in spring training, but it just seems like he's either in a guessing game or maybe seeing a little bit more deceptiveness from guys that he didn't see in spring training, where teams are coming up with a game plan for him. It seems like they're setting him up for power fastballs, and some guys he can catch up with him on, and other guys it seems like he's got a little bit of trouble on that. So it doesn't seem like it's necessarily, a bunch of swings and misses that off-speed stuff or anything like that, or that he's completely lost. I think it's just if he's not making quality contact, it doesn't seem like he's making much contact at all.
Well, the Tigers in general off to a great start. That's what's going on in the present. In the past tense, we've asked Jason Beck to contribute to the Franchise 4 project, which is ongoing at MLB.com. You can submit your votes until May 8th for the four guys you think have impacted the Tigers' history the most. Beck, I got to tell you, I only went through the AL Central for the good of these podcasts. I haven't done all 30 teams. Maybe I will later, but the Tigers definitely struck me as the easiest of the AL Central teams to nail down a Franchise 4. Let's hear yours.
Well, looking at the voting, Ty Cobb's obviously got to be on there. Hank Greenberg, I think as the years go on, people kind of forget the cultural significance of what he did and kind of what he meant for Jewish American ball players and Jewish Americans in general, especially during that frame in time. And also during his peak years, I think he was as good of a hitter as there was in the game. He was kind of Miguel Cabrera of his time there. I think he's got to be on there. I like having Alan Trammell on there. I think I know he's not in the Hall of Fame, and I know a lot of people are going to hold that against him. But to me, you kind of have to look at what he meant for even more than a generation, are arguably two generations of Tigers fans. It's not just what he meant to the people who grew up around those, the 84 team. I think what he's done since then and just the way he's carried himself and the connection he's had, you know, playing 20 years in the same uniform and then managing the team and then coming back now, and the way he carries himself and tries to teach the game, in some ways, I think he's this generation's K-line, you know, maybe without the, you know, the same credentials, but I think he has that type of significance for Tigers fans and for Tigers history. So I think, you know, for me, the four is, you know, Trammell, K-Line, Greenberg, and Cobb. And, you know, I know people, you know, Cabrera, I know he's doing very well in voting. And I think eventually he could end up cracking that four. I don't think he's there yet, A, because he didn't start out his career in Detroit. You know, he put up a lot of numbers in Florida beforehand. He got World Series in Florida. And B, I think there's still some time to go for him before we, you know, before we really see what type of impact he has, you know, into his mid-30s and beyond. Is he going to have that longevity? Every indication suggests yes, but, you know, it's hard to predict the future sometimes. So I'm not ready to put, you know, as good as Cabrera is, I think he ends up being one of the greatest right-handed hitters of all time. I hesitate to put him kind of in that realm just yet.
Well, this is the beauty of baseball. Nothing's easy. I think my hypothesis might have been incorrect, Beck, because I had Gehringer over Trammell, although you make great points about representing that 84 team. I think that is meaningful, so I can definitely hear their argument. I'm with you on Miggy. I do think, though, if Miggy gets enough series against the Indians between now and when he's 40, he'll probably slug his way onto that franchise four. But good stuff, Jason Beck. So get your votes in out there. And
we are talking to you live from Progressive Field, where the Royals are in town to face the Indians. And Royals, we talked about it last week. They developed quite a reputation for their friskiness on the field. And this is the first time, though, it's affecting them from a personnel standpoint now, with four suspensions handed out. It remains to be seen how exactly that shakes out as far as what guys are missing and when, but your overall takeaway from that situation in Chicago?
Well, Volquez already has dropped his appeal, so he's going to be out for 5 games. That's going to be felt immediately because they're going to miss his start on Friday. They're going to have to go with Chris Young probably, but that also, there are some ramifications for that because they're going to have to hold him back after tomorrow, so they're going to be short in the bullpen. Hey, it's a great story to be feisty and everything like that, but when the bill comes due, you know, you start to pay for it on the field, and we still don't know when Ventura's, you know, suspension is going to be meted out, so it's going to hurt them. There's no question about it, and Ned knows that, so I think we're going to see them kind of cool their jets a little bit here in the next week or so.
We were just talking to Ned, and like I said to him, I like the competitive spirit. You don't always see that in a club, and you like a club that responds when provoked, as long as it's responding in a positive way as far as your play. So I guess they are trying to find that fine line. And you know, there's certainly a chip on this club's collective shoulder, I guess you could say.
Yeah, you just don't want to get pushed around. And that's what they felt like what's been going on in the last few series. The first one, the very first incident, was in Anaheim. Well, actually, you go back to the White Sox series when they did get pushed around. Samardzija hit Kane on purpose. But the only one that's really, I would say, 100% their fault was probably the Ventura-Trout one, which didn't make sense to any of us. But all the other ones were stuff that they're not big trash talkers. They won't mouth off. And suddenly these things happen. You know, somebody slides hard into somebody with spikes up, or there's some jawing going on from somebody else. And they will stand up for themselves. I mean, they are defending AL champions. They want to go back and repeat and get back to the World Series, and there's a lot of people gunning him for him right now, and they just feel very strongly that they've got to stand up for themselves, and as a 25-man unit, they are.
Well, obviously, the fans are intrigued. They're getting record ratings on TV.
Every day.
There's the note here that was, every day is a new record, basically, and the latest was the last game in Chicago. But, yeah, how do you feel the fans? You were obviously in touch with the fans, especially via Twitter and stuff. How do you think they're responding to this group and the start?
I think they love it. And this has kind of picked up right where, in terms of fan interest, right where October left off. I mean, these numbers are, in Kansas City, they're just crazy numbers. We might get a 20 rating here And you start creeping up and you start talking about maybe what the Chiefs would get for a rating, which is usually 28, and the NFL, of course, dominates the ratings like that. But these are big, big numbers. It used to be where the Royals would get a 6 or 7 rating, and that was great. Well, now, I mean, that would just be horribly disappointing. They're breaking new kinds of records every day. Fans are loving it. There's more interest, I can sense. I mean, they also drew over 100,000 for that Oakland series in Kansas City. And those are big numbers, too. So, and even for a midweek, you know, early April cold series against the Twins for three games on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they drew almost 70,000, which it may not impress the people in Boston and New York, but it's pretty impressive for Kansas City to put those numbers up for a twin series. So there's great, great interest in the Royals in Kansas City right now, more than I've ever seen since I got there in 89. So it's pretty kind of cool to be around. I mean, it's neat.
How about the way the bullpen's holding up without Holland? That's an injury that could derail a lot of clubs to lose a closer like that. We talked going into the season about the depth they've accrued here and what a big difference maker that is for them.
And I think they're going to kind of skate past that one because they're going to have an off day next Monday. They had an off day, as it were, Saturday with the rain out. So that was another day of rest for Wade Davis. He's available now. They haven't had to run him out more than 2 days in a row yet. So they're kind of lucking out with the Holland injury. With all that depth, of course, you got Ryan Madsen, you got Frankie Morales, Herrera, and of course, Wade Davis is just one of the best pitchers in baseball right now. So they've got depth for now, but they are going to lose Herrera, remember, for seven games.
Right.
And that's going to sting. I mean, he's part of the HDH trio, and that won't be easy to fill out. But, you know, they just brought up Brandon Finnegan last week, and, you know, he was a big star last September and October. So they've got him for more depth. One thing nice about what Dayton's done is that every time something like this happens, he just reaches into a jar somewhere and pulls out another player, and they just keep, you know, kind of rambling on. So that's the way it's been.
I was just talking to Ned about Ryan Madsen, and obviously he's a great comeback story. I don't think I realized the intricacies there towards the end of the camp, and they were really they were ready to send him down basically, and put the word out there to other clubs as part of their gentleman's agreement with Madsen that he would be made available if anybody did want to have him on their 25-man roster. He said four or five clubs got back to him. We want him.
Yeah.
And so here, this is a guy they obviously decided to hold on to, and good decision there.
Yeah. I mean, Ned really wanted Ryan to go down maybe just for a week or two and try to go back-to-back a couple of days. He hadn't done that in spring at that point, so he really didn't know how he would be able to use him in April. Wasn't sure. And he would rather have somebody that he could go back-to-back days on. He already has Holchever in the minors right now who can't go back-to-back days yet either. So he just wanted to, it was just an availability thing. And there was sort of that gentleman's agreement. Ned brings that up a lot, but it depends on who you're talking to in the organization, whether it existed or not, because it's never those things aren't in writing. And if you tell a guy he's got to go down and he's under contract, guess what? You're going down. So, you know, it's been kind of a dicey little subject to talk about with certain members of the organization. And we'll just go with what Ned's saying for now. How's that?
It makes for a better story. It's if it's not in writing, it doesn't exist.
It really doesn't count.
That's kind of how the world works, unfortunately. But we asked Mr. Flanagan here to do his franchise four. We're asking all the readers out there, listeners, to go to MLB.com and cast their votes. I think you have till May 8th to do so. Picking the four players who have most impacted each franchise. So for the Royals, Jeffrey, who's your four?
Well, the obvious two are George Brett and Frank White. And then after that, I'm going to kind of differ from what the fans have voted. I think Hal McRae had a huge impact on this organization, the way they've played in the 70s and 80s. He did so as a manager, too. Just think Hal represents who the Royals were when they were great, along with George and Frank, of course. And I'll throw a recent one in, Mike Sweeney, who also, you know, represents this organization as best as they can. Good guy, played hard, you know, a lot of big numbers. Just recently went in the Royals Hall of Fame, so he's kind of a no-brainer for me, but I understand completely they went with Quiz and Brett Saberhagen. Saves was the only two-time Cy Young Award winner, and you can't really argue with that one at all either. So, you know, they're all good selections at the end of the day.
I like those picks. Frank White is an obvious choice for me as well. George Brett, obviously. Alex Gordon is on that ballot.
Yep.
And I'm not suggesting he be in the franchise four at this point, but certainly to be a leader of a that got this you know, on a team that, that got to the World Series for the first time in 29 years, that's no small thing. And,
no.
And you can certainly see him trending towards a franchise four type territory.
Yeah, I mean, if we do this every year, I mean, the minute maybe he gets to 10 years in the league or 11 years or 12, he's in. He's in. I mean, yeah, he's had that kind of impact on this team as well.
Yeah. All right, Jeffrey. So this is a big stretch for these guys.
Very big.
Coming up with the suspension situation looming overhead and some cold weather here in Cleveland, and then obviously a big series against Detroit. Mm-hmm. It sounds crazy to call anything a big series this early, but hey, the way both those two clubs shot out the gate, it is a big deal to match them up against each other.
Yeah, no, but neither Detroit or the Royals want to get too far behind each other. So,
yeah.
And they always have trouble with the Indians, especially in this ballpark. And so this is going to be an interesting test for the Royals. These are not three pitchers that they hit well. And their bats have kind of gone quiet in the last 5 or 6 days. So this will be a test. And then, of course, you mentioned Detroit. You got 4 games with them, kind of a big early season showdown, if you can have such a thing that early. But, you know, they don't want to – they've lost 2 straight. They don't want to just suddenly start to maybe go into Detroit with a – or go and playing Detroit with a 5-game losing streak or something like that.
Right.
This early in the season. Yeah, it's April, but, hey, these games still count as much as they do in September. And the Royals know who they're playing next, and then, so this is going to be kind of interesting. It's going to be kind of fun this week to see how they respond. We don't know when the suspensions will be handed out. The Royals are hoping they wait till after the Detroit series at least, so Ventura can go 1 game there. But we don't know. And of course, they're going to lose Herrera too for an extended period of time.
Yeah.
So we'll see how much depth they have. It's, you know, it's next man up mentality, and they're going to have to do that.
Yeah, well, I'll say it again. I love the way not just the record, but I just love the way they've come out, firing out the gate here this season.
Mm-hmm.
Terry Francona was just making the point. There's a guy who's been there, obviously, been to the top in this game, and he said, you know, the next season a team can go one of two ways. It can do the banquet circuit and really dig itself, or it can play with that energy
and
passion that got them there in the first place. So the Royals have definitely, been on the latter end of that this year. It's been good to see.
We are sitting live in the Progressive Field Media Dining Room, myself and Jordan Bastian. This is a very special podcast. This is an in-person podcast.
It is, and it's
first.
Fitting that we're sitting at a round table to have this discussion.
It is a round table. It is perfectly round, and it's got some ballpark mustard, so we're good to go.
We're good to go.
So all this noise you hear in the background, this is authentic, the noise we hear when eating substandard ballpark food before a baseball game.
Wow.
So this is the real deal,
wow.
Folks. We're going to talk about the Cleveland Indians. They are off to a substandard start.
Good segue.
Yeah, you like that? Not hitting the ball very consistently. Pitching pretty well overall. I think you would take some of these pitching performances, right, on the whole. I mean, there's some hiccups, don't get me wrong, but this is, you know, if you told me Trevor Bauer's going to have the month he had, sign up for that. Corey Kluber, of course. They're not supporting these guys, and a lot of that comes down to the top of the order. Michael Bourne gets demoted over the weekend. That was something that you probably saw coming after a while there. But talk about this lineup. They got some issues going on here, JB.
Yeah, I mean, the front four of that rotation, I think you could pretty much stack it up against any other rotation in the game right now. Obviously, there's been hiccups, but they've been great. They've done their part, and I mean, when Corey Kluber doesn't have a win yet, with what he's done, I think that kind of shows you some of the other issues that have been coming up in April. And you're right. I mean, the Michael Bourne issue, we've talked about it multiple times on previous podcasts and in the spring too, and we even brought it up before the season started with Francona, the fact that his on-base percentage over his 2 years prior with the Indians was not indicative of what a leadoff hitter should be.
Right.
So we question whether or not he should have been the leadoff hitter going into the year. You know, obviously, his stolen base numbers have been down, but, I mean, you can't steal first base. You got to get on. And I think, you know, Tito, to his credit, you know, made this move, I think, a little faster than we're used to Francona making moves. You know, usually you might take into May or even get towards June, but I think he really saw it became more glaring as a few other hitters in the lineup started to warm up, show signs of life. And all of a sudden, a guy like Michael Bourne and maybe even a guy like Jose Ramirez, you know, they start becoming a little more glaring. I thought it was the right move. You know, obviously, Kipnis isn't hitting the cover off the ball right now. But, you know, he's a guy that can steal bases, is on base percentages a little better. He sees more pitches than Bourne. I think that was the right way to go for now.
Yeah, for now, you tinker with the order of things. But What about personnel? Are we getting close to any personnel tinkering? And I think you know where I'm going with this. We were just talking about this pre-podcast about a young man by the name of Francisco Lindor who had a nice weekend, off to a pretty decent start at Columbus overall. What do you think of, there's a timetable to things, but is this something that could happen?
I mean, I think we all know Jose Ramirez is not the future at the position. I think he projects to be a utility man. And Lindor kind of is that guy, and we've kind of all accepted that Ramirez is going to keep his seat warm. But now as this lineup is struggling, and as I mentioned, as some guys are starting to come to life, Ramirez is one of those guys who hasn't shown those signs of life yet. And I've been a little surprised at how he's played in the field. I think we had 2 months of good baseball where he played at a strong level down the stretch last year, and the advanced metrics favored him. But so far, you know, even the things that don't necessarily go down as errors, right. You know, we've seen some decisions that we've had to ask about and things like that. And, you know, Lindor, I think, now is hitting over 300. I mean, sample size alert for everybody at this time of year. I mean, I think he was hitting 190 a week ago,
right. Yeah.
And now he's hitting 300, and now it's a hot start. So, you know, it'll be interesting. But, I mean, they've passed that day where they've secured an extra year of free agency. If they're going to play the business game and try and, you know, drag it to June where you start talking about arbitration situations, you know, that business side of the game that the fans who are watching a substandard team right now don't want to hear about.
Right.
But, I mean, is that the only reason they're keeping him down? Because performance-wise, maturity-wise, leadership-wise, I don't see why he couldn't be in the lineup right now,
yeah,
giving them elite defense and doing at least what Jose Ramirez is doing right now.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And, yeah, I mean, Ramirez, the one big selling point was he's supposed to be substantially improvement on the defensive end, and they still had some defensive struggles. And their pitchers have struggled defensively as well.
I
saw there was a Fangrass had a really nice breakdown of that, but it really did hammer home that point too. So not a great start for the Tribe, and it's amplified all the more by what Detroit and Kansas City, their opponent this week, have done. What is your sense of the clubhouse and the panic level, I guess, overall right now?
Well, David Murphy already used the sense of urgency quote after the game in Detroit. You know, I go back to, and I think I wrote this last night, was at the end of the season last year, Michael Bourne stood in front of his locker and had a great in-depth chat with us for about 15 minutes, you know, just kind of breaking down what went wrong last year, and, you know, why their backs were up against the wall. And what he pointed to was that slow April start. And once they got through that, then they played great baseball. But then they finished 3 games out, just missed a playoff spot. And he said, you know, we need to win early. You got to get off to that hot start. That way, if you do hit issues, you have that buffer. And I think they obviously did not do that this year. And you could potentially be looking at the same type of situation where, much like they've done in individual games with the Tigers, playing catch-up after being down early, you're looking at a situation where now maybe it's the next 5 months of trying to play catch up, because the Tigers and Royals have gotten off to great starts and the Indians have not. And it's almost mirrored to what happened last year.
They haven't gotten off to great starts in the Terry Francona era. As good as this era has been, and they haven't had back to back winning seasons in a long time. He's done that, but slow start. And that was it's kind of the organization history around here. Eric Wedge was always hammered for
a slow
start.
It's cold in Cleveland, Anthony.
I guess so, man. I'm off to a slow start. How's your start?
I do want to point out, too, I mean, I feel like I've been on the road for all of April. I mean, they've only played 5 games here at home. They're about to open a homestand. So, I mean, you got to take that into the equation, too. A lot of times you say if a team can play 500 ball on the road and take care of business at home, you know, they'll be in good shape. And maybe that's what ends up happening. But, I mean, it's been a rough start, and I think there's been a lot of factors. Bullpen hasn't been great. Offense has struggled. But again, when you look at that starting rotation, you see that hope that if they can keep doing that, you know, if you could just get just enough offense, you know, maybe they could be there in the end. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, programming note here, MLB.com, voting going on for the franchise 4 through May 8th. You pick the 4 guys who have most impacted that franchise in
its
history.
Like the Mount Rushmore.
The Mount Rushmore of each team, exactly. And Michael Bourne is not on the Indians' Mount Rushmore to this point.
Right.
To this point. We'll give him time to, you know, get hot here. But I don't think he's going to make the franchise 4, I got to be honest. The people want to hear Jordan Bastian's franchise 4 for the Cleveland Indians.
But I think it's a no-brainer. Your number one there is Bob Feller. He's got the...
Never heard of him, but sounds like a great guy.
Anyway, yeah, the only opening day no-hitter, Hall of Famer, just the persona that he was.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy that to this date resonates with Indians fans, and that says a lot about a guy's career and impact he had. Then I got to go Larry Doby. You know, Jackie Robinson gets so much credit for being the first African American to break into baseball. Larry Doby was the first into the American League. Kind of goes unheralded every year. You know, I think it's great they're finally putting a statue in and having a Larry Doby Day here. It's going to be great. You know, I hope that his legacy continues to gather steam over time. I'll go Jim Thome. I know there's some fans that still are bitter about some things that happened in his career and decisions that were made in free agency, but he's the franchise leader in home runs, and whether you like it or not, he's got a statue outside Gate C now, too. The fourth one, you know, I kind of weighed this. You got Lou Boudreau, who stands out to me, but I'm going to go with Nap Lajoie. I mean, this franchise at one point was called the Cleveland Naps, you know, after him, a Hall of Famer. You know, I just think that right there, the franchise tie and things like that. I think he's my fourth.
Okay. Good choices. I had Lou Boudreau over Nap Lajoie.
Yeah, I wrestled over that one.
Mainly, I wanted to represent the 48, you know, player-manager in 48 last time they won a World Series here, so that's a big deal to me. And, yeah, I went with Thome. I don't know. You got to have somebody representing those great 90s teams. Obviously, the Indians used him as the representative with the statue. I wrote about it at the time. I don't blame them for using Thome as the representative. I thought maybe there would have been a way to do it that honored the whole feel with him catching the last out when they clinched. But I have no problem with Jim Thome representing that group.
A lot of fans, I think, would love to see Omar. You know,
Omar, Kenny Lofton, obviously. I guess I go Thome because he was drafted by the Indians, so I think he also represents that wave of players that were homegrown. So.
Right.
So I go with Thome, and I know there'll be a lot of debate about that, but it's a fun debate.
Hoynsey.
So, Hoynsey should have a little, he should be in the background, I guess.
Okay, maybe he's covering them, you know?
Yeah.
He covered all of those players we mentioned, I believe.
We could do quite a press box, Mount Rushmore.
Oh, man.
In this press box.
Oh, boy.
And you know what? While we're here, I want to hear your review of the media dining experience.
Oh, we're going down, this is a slippery slope, man.
Yeah, I mean... this is some inside baseball stuff. We're sitting here, and everybody, I think, maybe can hear them preparing for tonight's meal. I want to hear what is the best and worst the Press Box Dining has to offer for you?
Well, they have a Keurig coffee machine now,
that's
which
great.
Is clutch.
Yes.
Although,
I got to tell you, I still don't know how to use that thing. It always takes me 3 attempts just to get a cup of tea. I always go through 2 cups.
It's really hard. You put the thing in and you push the button.
Yeah, and I always really do difficult. Something out of order, out of sequence, because
push the button
I
before you put the cup
yeah,
in.
Yeah, inevitably lose 2 cups before I get the real cup, so I'm killing the environment.
Tell you what, I mean, they've been developing this media dining over the last few years. It's finally reaching big league level.
It is.
You know, I think it's ready. you know, they got
much like Francisco Lindor.
They got some good options here. If you don't like the main course, you can, you know, make a sandwich, get a burger, and I think that's clutch. I think that's key. You got to have some good backup options.
I have been making fun of the press dining here for a decade now. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like
it's your
innate.
Thing.
Yeah, it's my thing. But I will say, yeah, it's definitely gotten better. The chicken salad's pretty good. I kind of like the chicken salad. Make a chicken salad sandwich. That's pretty good.
Lucille, when you see Lucille's face when you walk in,
it just brightens your day.
Yeah, I think that's the best part.
Well, we've hit all the hot topics. All the important information is on this podcast. I want to thank you for tuning in, and thank Jordan Bastian for joining us. This has been MLB.com Extras, Cleveland Indians edition.
Merck, were you in that dog pile on the field there, that ruckus with the Royals? Were you in the middle of all that?
No, and luckily the White Sox beat writers and the Royals beat writers did not pair off either and fight in the press box. So we just kind of stayed and watched and reviewed video, probably what the Major League Baseball office did after the fight, and just it was crazy. It was a crazy series between the fight and then a suspended game and then a rainout and then a couple comebacks by the White Sox. So it was kind of an interesting weekend overall.
It was. There's a lot to unpack there, especially from that brawl, and Matt Albers came out with a broken finger, correct?
Yeah, a compression fracture. Easy for me to say, a compression fracture of his right pinky. So, you know, it sounds like this is going to be more than a couple weeks just because he can't really grip the ball, so he can't do much while it's healing, so I'm guessing he's going to have to go on some sort of rehab assignment. But, you know, the good thing is they have Scott Carroll, who was outstanding in this role last year, and, you know, has the ability to even spot start if they need him to. So he kind of not only fills the role that Albers is pitching, which was, you know, a couple innings at a time, he can even go longer. So if they need 3 or 4, Scott Carroll is the guy who can do that.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, it gets more attention, but Sale and Samardzija both suspended for 5 games, and the White Sox are going to have to navigate their way around that one way or another. Of course, both those guys are appealing, and it looks like they'll make their next scheduled start. But Merck, from what I read, what you wrote, it sounds like they can avoid having to fill two spots, even if those guys both serve the full term of their suspension. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, they could play the appeal out, but let's say in the story I mentioned, you know, hypothetically, Samardzija pitches Tuesday in Baltimore, Sale pitches Wednesday after Noesi pitches Monday, and let's say they each drop their suspension after they pitch and take the 5 days. Well, with an off day this coming Monday, then you would only need to fill a Sunday spot. You'd be able to pitch. Everyone would be able to come back with their 5 days served and on regular rest, which is Sunday, and that, you know, could very well be Carlos Rodon. That could very well be Scott Carroll. Now, that's hypothetically. They may go full appeal, and this may be a little bit, and, you know, they may even stagger the suspensions to make sure it's only, like, you know, one start here or one start there. But if they were, to hypothetically take them, start them as soon as their start's over, so Samardzija's suspension would start Wednesday and Sale's Thursday, they would pretty much stay in turn and just need to fill Sunday afternoon at Target Field.
And Mr. Rodon, would he be penciled in for that one?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about Carlos is obviously that was a lot of tweets I got right away when, you know, you heard that Sale or Samardzija were going to be suspended. It was like, okay, Carlos Rodon's starting career begins. But the Sox are being rightfully careful in that. You know, this is his first full season out of college. He was, at this point last year, he was at North Carolina State. And, you know, they're not going to throw him 200 innings. They're not going to throw him 180 innings probably. So, you know, they feel, not still, I shouldn't say still, because 17 games of the season, they definitely feel like they have a special season in the making, and Carlos Rodon could be a big part of that. So I don't think they want to encounter a Strasburg-type situation in Washington where, you know, he's got to be shut down in September because they started in the rotation too early. So to make a long answer shorter, yes, he definitely, as Robin said, he definitely is in the mix for that spot start, and he definitely will be a starter sooner or later. But it could very well be Scott Carroll. And, you know, if it's a one-star thing, it very well could be Scott Carroll. And then just kind of push Rodon's starting date back a little bit.
Well, that's just boring, Merck. Scott Carroll, no offense to Scott Carroll and his family, but I want to see Carlos Rodon and get a start.
Yeah, I think it'll probably be Carlos Rodon. We'll go with that. I think it'll probably be him, but it's not necessarily a situation where if he gets the start that he's going to be in the rotation from that point on. You know, he is stretched out. Right. He threw 60 pitches the Tuesday game against, I guess it was Cleveland, right? Yeah, he threw 60 pitches in that game, his major league debut. He hadn't pitched since then. And, you know, he was a starter at Charlotte. So he's definitely stressed out. So it would not be a problem for him to jump into the rotation and, you know, probably be expected to go 5 or 6 innings. So he's there. So I'm just laying the options out for you, Anthony. But I will pass it along to Rick Hahn and Ken Williams that Scott Carroll, a little bit boring as a start. Carlos Rodon is the guy you want.
I'm just looking out for all those fantasy baseball owners who picked up Carlos Rodon when Adam Wainwright went down for the year. You know, they needed somebody, and hoping he could fill in for them. But
I'm currently tied for first in my league. I have Mike Trout, and Adrian Gonzalez, so that kind of helps on my team.
Nobody cares about your fantasy team, Merck. All right, let's move on. Gordon,
it's better than the Eagles from Michigan, right? So I just figured I'd throw something related in at least.
I wanted to ask you about Gordon Beckham. Gordon Beckham's off to a really nice start offensively. Kind of a guy who obviously lost his way after a big breakout early in his career, and then the White Sox trade him last year, bring him back. Do you think, could he push himself into an expanded role in this offense, or are we seeing good numbers from him because he benefits from a more limited role?
Well, I think the answer to both questions is yes. I mean, I think the White Sox really like him in that sort of, you know, super utility role where he can play third base against a tough lefty or second base against a tough lefty, can play defense late in the game, and third or second if they need him, can even, you know, step in and short if Alexi Ramirez needs a day off or an inning or two off. But, you know, I mean, they want to win. So I know Connor Gillespie had a big hit in that Sunday comeback in the regular game against the Royals, and certainly has played well enough so far. But, you know, they want to be a division-winning team, and if Gordon Beckham eventually is the guy who's going to, you know, give them a better shot, then I could see him playing a more regular role. But, you know, they designed for him to be the super utility role. He's done a great job of it through basically 1 month of the season. And right now, I don't think it's going to change.
Is Gordon Beckham on your fantasy team, by any chance?
Gordon Beckham is not on my fantasy team, but Zach Putnam is because he went to Michigan.
Ah. Well, speaking of which, Merck, all right, we're gonna wrap this podcast up with your franchise four. Everybody visiting MLB.com can vote for their franchise four of any franchise they like. Voting goes through May 8th, and the results will be revealed at the All-Star game. So I asked you to pick out your franchise four for the White Sox. I'm thinking if you could redo Mount Rushmore, you wouldn't pick four White Sox guys. You'd do like three Eagles and Jim Harbaugh. You'd have like Don Henley, Glenn Frey, right?
Or just four different faces of Jim Harbaugh would work, too. Either one of those would be good, I think.
Actually, I do wonder who would be your third Eagle. Would it be Timothy B. Schmidt or Joe Walsh would be your third Eagle, of course.
No, Joe Walsh would be my first Eagle. Joe Walsh, I think, is the most entertaining of that group. I mean, they're all good. Let's face it. They're the best, yeah. As you well agree. But Joe Walsh is pretty amazing to watch. So yeah, he'd be right behind Harbaugh on that Mount Rushmore, I think.
All right. Well, we've gone off topic as we tend to do. But yeah, I wanted to get your opinion. All right. So for the White Sox, who's your franchise four for the White Sox?
Well, you know, I think three are pretty easy. Especially if you go by the eight great candidates on the ballot, Frank Thomas was the best hitter in White Sox history and a Hall of Famer. You know, no question about it. Minnie Minoso was one of the game's greatest ambassadors. And, you know, people don't totally believe this, but I'm a little young to have seen him play. And from what people tell me, just a dominant force on the field as well, besides being the first Hispanic black player in White Sox franchise history. And Paul Konerko, not only great stats, but probably one of the best leaders in Chicago sports, let alone White Sox sports. And I know, you know, people don't like to quantify the leadership stat. You can't put that into a formula or anything, but he had pretty darn good numbers too. You know, 439 homers, 279 career average, 1412 RBIs, won a World Series. So I put those three, and then it's hard to pick a fourth one. And, you know, I guess they're basing it totally on the field, right? So, I mean, because if you're going to go just meaning to the franchise overall as a player and elsewhere, it would be Ozzie Guillen. Because Ozzie Guillen had a great playing career for them and then won a World Series as a manager and managed 8 years for that team. So I would think, you know, he would be the fourth. If you're going player, man, there's a lot of good choices. I would guess Luke Appling would have to be the fourth one in my mind. You know, Harold Baines, Eddie Collins, Louis Aparicio, Nelly Fox, all on the ballot, all outstanding players. But I would just think Luke Appling would be my fourth, unless you're going big picture, overall meaning, player, and everything else to the team. And that would be Ozzie Guillen. And of course, if you're doing that, you could put Jerry Reinsdorf in that too. So a lot of options. So I have three firm ones, and then it's a toss-up depending on the criteria for number four.
Yeah, I feel your conflicting emotions about this, whether it goes statistical or otherwise, because yeah, Luke Appling is the career WAR leader for the White Sox. For anybody who cares about that, obviously he's got the numbers to be in this sort of thing. Frank Thomas is a no-brainer for me. Louis Aparicio, great defender, led the league in steals his first nine seasons. I think he merits some mentioning here. And Harold Baines, am I wrong, Merck? Didn't they retire Harold Baines' number like as soon as he was traded?
Yes, they did. Yeah, and it's still
I mean,
there.
Now, you know,
Harold,
right there. Yeah.
Harold's contributed part of the coaching staff too. So I mean, Harold's done more off on you know in the dugout as well as on the field for the team too. You know, really, the more I think about it, you know, I know he's not a player, but you'd have to almost if you're doing the Mount Rushmore or the top four of White Sox, you'd have to pick the four players. And then you'd have to put Jerry Reinsdorf in there, too, just for what he's meant to the franchise and what owned the team since, I believe, 81. So, I mean, that's a pretty significant, you know, commitment to White Sox baseball. But if we're going strictly players, I would think Luke Appling, again, with a second asterisk. I have a lot of asterisks on this ballot. To Ozzie Guillen for what he did as a player and as a manager.
Yeah, those are all good choices. And I like the Paul Konerko choice. I know statistically that might not hold a great deal of water, but, hey, winning the World Series in 05, that's a big deal. I think that deserves some kind of recognition and something like this. So, good stuff from Scott Merkin. And, Rhett, the good news with the Twins, the rotation has really turned things around. Go back and look at the first seven games of the season, had a 6.87 ERA. In their last 11 games, it's a 3.15 ERA. What's been the big key to that turnaround in your mind?
Well, I think more than anything, it's just getting good starts from guys that you weren't really sure how they're going to do. Guys like Mike Pelfrey. So far, it's definitely turned it around. Had a great start against Kansas City, throwing seven scoreless. Malone's been pretty good throughout all his starts. Trevor May has pitched pretty well, obviously, not hitting the arm there in Seattle. Apparently, he's okay. I guess we'll get an update early this week and kind of find out how hurt he really is. But
And they're trying to think, those guys, and even Hughes, the game they lost in Seattle with Felix pitching, Hughes threw a complete game, 8 innings, with 9 strikeouts. They just lost 2-0. So I think more than anything, we're starting to see some consistency from this rotation. Like I said, some of these guys, May, Gibson, you know, and Tupper, some of these guys aren't really sure how they're going to fare, have definitely started to fare a lot better now, second time, third time starting.
And it sounds like Ricky Nolasco's on track. He made his rehab outing on Sunday. What are the reports on that?
He did fine. Yeah, he did fine. I think he gave one unearned run over there at Cedar Rapids. I think we'll find out today if he needs another one. I think he only threw about 5 innings or so. So I'm thinking he'll probably need one more before he's ready to go. But definitely a good sign. And like I said, I think early on that injury was more about precaution than anything else. The fact that there was just inflammation, kind of wanted to back him off a little bit. Definitely good news. There was no major injury there at all in the elbow. So a good sign. He got through that first rehab start with no issues. We'll kind of see where they take him from there.
I wanted to ask you, Rhett. We talked a little about this in the offseason. Joe Mauer batting leadoff. I know it's something Paul Molitor has at least considered. I don't know how seriously he's considered it, but, you know, you look at the struggles at the top of the order in general, and you look at Mauer's skill set at this point in his career and getting on base frequently, not a lot of extra base hits. So is there some grease on that fire? Is that something that could happen?
I think it's something that makes sense. You know, you're right. I think because Joe does get on base so much, and really is actually a pretty good base runner. I think he made a mistake there in Kansas City running the bases, but that was pretty rare. He's not like the fastest guy in the world, but he's definitely a very smart base runner. At the same time, just from talking to Mauer, especially during spring training, he seemed like he was definitely more leaning toward guys that are speedy at the top of the lineup. So that's why he liked Santana so much. That's why now that Santana got moved down to ninth on Sunday that he had Dozier leading off. Because although Dozier does have some power, obviously, he also has speed and stole, you know, more than 20 bases last year. So they've been kind of going with Dozier at the top of the lineup now with Santana struggling, but I do think it would make a little more sense if they went Mauer 1 and maybe Dozier 2 instead of the other way around. And now they're kind of having Mauer back 3rd, and kind of the second spot in order now too is kind of being mixed up here and there. I think they had Shane Robinson back there. Yeah. Torrey Hunter's batted there a little bit ever since he started off the season as a cleanup hitter. So it's been kind of interesting seeing the way they've kind of worked the lineup, because so far the offense really hasn't gotten going yet.
It hasn't. And as you mentioned, Danny Santana, his struggles have been a big part of that. You mentioned him going down the 9-hole. The day before that, Eduardo Escobar was in there in place with him and hit a home run. Is that an issue that Escobar could force? Could we see more of Escobar at short?
We could. I think the Twins would still like to see Santana kind of bounce back. I think more than anything, I think people knew that Santana wasn't going to probably be as good as he was last year based on a few factors, including even his minor league track record. But I think the Twins still have confidence in him better than he's been so far, for sure. But I do think you're right. I think that if he continues to struggle and really can't turn it around, I think this was kind of the first step, was moving him off the leadoff spot to ninth. That's kind of the thing they're waiting a while to do. They didn't really want to do, but he kind of forced their hand because of the way he was playing. They kind of had to move him back in the lineup. I think if he continues to hit the way that he has, batting ninth, I do think we can see more Escobar, and potentially, I think the Twins are definitely hesitant and don't want to do it. But if he really continues to really, really struggle the way that he has, I mean, you could see them maybe even setting him down to AAA to kind of get back on track there and just have Escobar become the starting shortstop with Nunez as the backup. I think the Twins don't want to do that yet, but at the same time, it's got to kind of pick it up here pretty soon.
Yeah, I think there was a general expectation with Santana had such a high batting average on balls in play, for instance, last season, that you expected regression, but I'd say this has probably been more regression than the Twins bargained for.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, that's, like you said, the balls in batting average and balls in play, I think, was above 400 last year, which led the league. I think, looking at the stats, like guys like Mike Trout and Andrew McCutchen had batting averages and balls in play around 350. So you can still, even the league average is around 300. If you hit the ball hard and hit a lot of line drives and you can run, you can have a higher one, but a 400 one, that's pretty much unheard of and really isn't something you can really repeat. So I think people thought maybe he'd come back down to earth a little bit, but you're right. I don't think anyone saw it coming this bad this early.
Red, you hear much about Byron Buxton? I know he got off to a little bit of a slower start in the minors. What's the word on him?
Well, he did hit a 3-run home run the other night, which is a good sign from him. But you're all right. He's gone off to a little bit of a slow start. Same with Miguel Sano at Double-A. A little expected. I mean, obviously, you want the top prospect in baseball to come off to a hot start and all that. But considering that he missed, you know, pretty much all of last year outside of 30 games or so from all the injuries that he had, you kind of expected some rust. Same with Sano missing all of last year with Tommy John. You kind of expect some of that rust there. So I think that no one's really worried yet, but I do think that obviously they want both Bucks and Minnesota to kind of pick it up here, especially maybe once it gets a little warmer. I don't know how. And Cedar Rapids isn't Chattanooga isn't that in a cold of an area compared to maybe if they would have been at New Britain, but they switched affiliations this year. But I do think that maybe once it gets a little warmer, maybe they just maybe pick it up a little bit. But I do think that so far both have struggled, and I think some would like to see do the rest.
Well, if they're going to play in Minnesota, they better get used to cold weather to start the season. But obviously a lot of eyes on those guys, a lot of hope that they can make a meaningful impact maybe by the end of this year. But for now, it's good to see the rotation turn things around, because that's obviously a big key for the Twins, just being a competitive ball club. But that's what's going on in the present. But we want to talk a little Twins past right now with Rhett. And I asked him, as all of you out there are being asked to vote on MLB.com for your franchise four. You pick out the four players who had the biggest impact on this club in its long history. And I think, Rhett, with the Twins, I think there's a couple obvious picks. And I think the last spot, to me, it gets pretty complicated. It depends what you value and where. So I want to hear your franchise four.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of interesting with the Twins, especially having their history with the Washington Senators. I think obviously right. having Walter Johnson on that right. list. He's probably the best player on that list. I mean, Walter Johnson definitely has a case to be the best pitcher in the history of the game. But I just think that, for me, I kind of lean more towards the Minnesota Twins history a little bit. So to me, I think that an obvious one and number one, I think, Harmon Killebrew, being a Hall of Famer, all the power he had, is an obvious one. To me, same thing with Kirby Puckett, a guy that is a Hall of Famer and is probably the most beloved player in franchise history from all listed on the field with, you know, the two World Series and just his charisma and personality. I mean, obviously some of the stuff off the field maybe tainted that a little bit, but I think in Minnesota he's definitely still beloved. And I think those two are very obvious. I think same thing with Rod Carew. I mean, Rod Carew is one of the best, you know, pure hitters, I guess you could say, in the history of baseball. And I guess that last spot's a tough one, too, because you have a Hall of Famer in Burt Blyleven, who's on that list, but I believe it's someone that he also had, you know, success elsewhere, though. He didn't have his whole career in Minnesota. He did win one World Series there, but obviously played with the Pirates and the Indians, among other teams. So for that reason, I might leave him off the Twins one just because he didn't spend his whole career here. Which makes it a little bit more difficult. For me, and obviously Joe Mauer, an active guy, we've talked plenty about Joe. I think maybe in a few years, if Joe can kind of bounce back to the levels of performance that he had early in his career, I think that would be a no-brainer. I think that he's more underrated and probably underappreciated in Minnesota just because he's been a guy that gets on base so much and does things maybe are a little bit undervalued compared to a guy that hits a bunch of home runs or something like that or gets a bunch of RBIs. But for me, I think that final spot would be Tony Oliva. Just the same thing. I think he's a guy that is beloved within the organization, has been a part of the organization for a really long time and still represents the organization and is just was a great player and someone that was hurt by knee injuries. And I think that the modern medicine nowadays would have prolonged his career and he would have been an easy Hall of Famer. I think that he still has a really good case to be Hall of Famer, and we saw him just miss out by one vote in the Hall of Fame. Just this past December. So for me, I put Oliva in there just because he played his whole career with the Twins, although it was a little bit short by the knee injuries. So for me, I'd be the three kind of the obvious ones of those Hall of Famers, and then Oliva. It'd be tough leaving out, obviously, Johnson, who's a Hall of Famer too, but played mostly in Washington and Blyleven and Mauer and all those. So definitely a good list, but for me, that's my four.
I think he did well with the red, and I think that is tough, that last spot. How much attention should we pay to the Washington Senators with this? You know, their history kind of gets just washed out as a result of, you know, the way history went. But Walter Johnson certainly deserves discussion in a project like this, but obviously doesn't have the Minnesota ties. So I think he did well with it. I was actually surprised Kent Herbeck wasn't on the ballot. Not that he's going to crack that top four, but he was one of the names.
I was too. Especially spent his whole career there and from here. I thought that he might have been on there too, but it's tough when you have to make only eight choices and right. He's had some pretty good players throughout the years.
Yeah. Well, as Rhett said, eight guys on the ballot. You all can narrow that down. You have until May 8th to get your votes in. You heard Rhett's and his rationale behind them. I think it was good choices by you, Rhett. Good work out of you. Thanks for joining us. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you next time. It's been MLB.com Extras, Minnesota Twins edition.